Chapter 11. Chief of State Cal Omas today authorized new emergency measures to crack down on continuing unrest in Galactic City. Corellian passport holders now have 48 hours to report to their local CSF precinct and opt for repatriation or face internment. The move has been condemned by Senate representatives from Altir 5, Oberdan, and Katrasi. Meanwhile, anti-terror squads raided homes in the Adur quarter overnight and seized explosives and blasters. 10 men and 3 women have been charged with conspiracy to cause explosions. HNE Lunchtime News Bulletin. Arcanian Microtechnologies Headquarters, Vohai. If there was a weak point in any perimeter, Boba Fett would find it. And he had. He watched a small bird, a hummer, bright scarlet, perch on the top of the 4-meter-high perimeter fence that ran for 6 kilometers around Arcanian Micro's headquarters, and noted that there was no reaction from the guards in the gatehouse. There was no point having a security system so sensitive that birds could set it off, and if a bird could get over that fence, then so could Fett. Security cams didn't cover much beyond 100 meters around each guarded gate. It all depended on the sensors that detected entry at any unsupervised point along or over the fence, and that was a weak point for a man with a custom disruptor. The sensors projected a slim, movement-sensitive ellipse along the entire cross-section of the fence, generated from ground level and extending 2 meters on either side of it. And if the sweep from orbit by Slave One scanners was correct, 200 meters above it to thwart aerial incursions. Or intruders with jetpacks, of course. Fett didn't take that personally. But the sensors didn't react to small objects. Fett stood back from the 2-meter line and took 2 long wires with gription clips. He cast one like an angler, looping it out from shoulder height, just as he had when fishing for devies from the landing pad of his Tippica City home as a kid. The clip snapped onto the mesh of the fence, insubstantial as a hummer. Then Fett cast the other wire 2 meters along the fence, attaching a second gription clip. He now had 2 long lines that enabled him to attach his disruptor without breaching the sensor field. Standing inside the bite of the wires, he plugged them into the casing of the disruptor and pressed the key. He was now as good as inside. As far as the detection system could tell, there was an unbreached perimeter. The wires were effectively a loop in the fence, and the bypass section of fence itself didn't exist. Fett adjusted the controls of his jetpack and soared over the fence, landing carefully within the bypassed zone. He memorized the section, visible only by looking for the gription clips. The palm-sized disruptor itself nestled unobtrusively in the grass beyond. Fett sprinted to the cover of the wall and jetted to the flat roof. Normally, he would have fired his grappling hook and climbed, but speed mattered now. It was worth the extra jetpack fuel. He lay on his belly and crept across the roof, his visor almost touching the gravelly surface as the penetrating radar scanned for people within. It was a huge area to cover. He pressed a medical sound sensor, more sensitive than the military ones, to the roof to pick up what signal he could. From the sound of the conversation immediately below him, a woman recording someone's educational details, he had landed over the personnel department, and he was still crawling across offices that had external windows. Town Wee would be somewhere far from daylight, right at the center. It took him more than 2 hours to edge his way across what seemed to him a featureless charcoal-gray cinder plain, listening for clues to what lay beneath, and watching the radar outlines of bodies moving. He hoped that the disruptor would still be there when it came time to leave, but if it wasn't, it would be far easier to make a run for it on the way out than on the way in. "This is really hurting my hips and my chest." Fat lifted his body slightly and took his weight on his knees and elbows. He heard the clink of glass dishes, and the whoosh and ump of chiller cabinets opening and closing. He saw people sitting, probably at a long bench, and others clustered around a table. The outlines of the inorganic objects were almost impossible to make out, but he was used to assembling a mental image from the scant cues provided by the movement and shape of bodies. He'd seen a few labs in his time. He knew how town we liked hers laid out. When she'd had a leg cloned for him a few years before, her typical laboratory had still been just like it was when he was a kid, and she had first shown him around. He heard the occasional word that sounded like a conversation about a scanning microscope. "Could mean anything, but I'm over the labs, that's for sure. Next vent I find, next point of entry, I'm going down there." He checked the chrono readout in his helmet, shifting his focus and feeling the beginning of a headache. 3 hours. Too slow. The longer he took, the more vulnerable he was to discovery. "You don't quit now, Fett." And then he heard it. Just a couple of words. It wasn't even anything from which he could derive meaning. But he knew that tone, that pitch, so very well that it was like hearing his own name whispered in a crowded, noisy room. Everything else fell silent as his brain filtered out all irrelevance. It was Town Wee's fluting, gentle voice. He forgot the raw ache in his sternum and felt the adrenaline course through his body, erasing every pain. "Gotcha." He frame-grabbed the coordinates in his HUD, got to his knees, and scouted around for an air vent. There was a biohazard containment opening 50 meters across the roof, the kind of hatch that a hazmat team would use to enter the building if it was ever contaminated and sealed, and he knew it would yield to the lock overrides on his wristband. He hadn't met a lock, seal, or panel that didn't, and it was designed to take someone wearing a full hazmat suit. For once, his jetpack wasn't an encumbrance, as he took a security blade from his shin pocket to bypass the breach alarm and opened the hatch. He slid down the vent and found himself standing in a chamber with 2 doors leading off it. Both were locked. When he switched to his HUD's normal vision, the glow around him was that dull amber emergency lighting, and a safety notice on the wall read, "Last inspected, 6-8-1-36. He adjusted his helmet's sound sensors and listened. The corridor outside was clear. A quick flick back to the terahertz radar scan confirmed it. He made his way down the corridor, checking as he went, following the occasional sound of Town Wee's voice, until he found himself outside an office with 2 shapes visible inside on his helmet scanner. 1, dense human body, and a Kaminoan one, with its characteristic abdominal spaces. Fett ducked into the nearest alcove, a fire control station, and waited for the human to leave. Eventually, the doors opened and a woman left. The lock panel at the side of the doors flashed again, but Fett slid a blade from his override system into the slot, and the doors parted with a whisper. He took the precaution of locking them behind him. Leaning over the desk, a tall creature with a long, graceful neck and small, round, gray head was engrossed in work at a data screen. Town Wee didn't turn around.
"Please leave the file in the tray."
"Nice place you got here."
Kaminoans never showed emotion, but the speed with which Town Wee whipped around and the way her head jerked back on seeing him told him she was surprised.
"Popa?"
"Oddly, there's only one."
"How did you find me?"
"It's my job, remember?"
Fett walked slowly across the room and propped his backside on the edge of her desk. He lifted his helmet.
"Let's say I followed the money."
"Koane sent you to—"
"No, he wants the data back, but that's not why I'm here."
Town Wee stared into his face, blinking slowly. She knew him about as well as anyone alive, and that wasn't a long list. She looked old, very old.
"Are you all right, Boba? Is your leg functioning properly?"
"No. In fact, my whole body is giving me a few problems."
"Can I be of help?"
"I'm suffering from tissue degeneration, liver problems, autoimmune diseases, tumors. My doctor says I have a year or so to live if I'm lucky."
He reached in his belt for a data chip.
"Take a look at the tests."
Town Wee took the chip with long, thin fingers and slid it into her data port.
"Ah," she said, "I see."
She got up and went to a cabinet, and Fett's natural mistrust of the galaxy kicked in. If she could run out on her own government, she could betray him. He clicked his blaster just as a warning. Town Wee turned slowly and glanced at the blaster.
"Do you think I would wish to draw attention to the fact that you tracked me down and gained access to my secure office?"
"You stole data and defected. Never had you down for that kind, either." "Did I ever care about Town Wee?" "I think I did."
Fett thought that it was funny how you never truly recalled how you felt as a child, except for the defining moments. And he was defined by his love of his father, and he knew it, and he was proud of it. When the idea occurred to him that it was all he was, he shook it off.
"I miss Dad every single day, every single minute. I want to live up to him."
Fat motioned Town Wee to sit down with the barrel of his blaster. She settled in the chair, hands clasped, and didn't react at all. No fear, no surprise, no affection. She was ice, control, indifference.
"You brought me up, more or less."
"Boba," she said.
She still had that soothing, musical voice. He wasn't sure how long Kaminoans lived, but she had to be coming to the end of her life.
"I regret that I don't have the skills to help you."
"You're the nearest I ever had to a mother, and that scares me sometimes."
"I guessed as much," said Fett. "I just want your data. And some information."
"She's completely cold. I was just another experiment she was pleased with."
"My data belongs to Arcanian Micro."
"The data belongs to the Kaminoan government. But seeing as they aren't paying me, I'll take it to cover my expenses."
"I can't hand it over."
"So I'll take it."
Fett slipped the data breaker from a pouch on his belt and flipped it over in his left hand. He selected the docking interface that fit Arcanian Micro's computer system. The device had a dozen different plugs that rotated into position on a wheel. Or copy it, anyway. I don't plan to sell it. Yet.
Town Wee blinked slowly. She had the eyes of the Kaminoan ruling class. Gray, not yellow. Not low-caste blue.
"It will ruin Arcanian Micro."
"Tough."
"And it will ruin me. Do you feel no compassion for me, Boba?"
"No, I don't believe I do. Not now."
Town Wee appeared to be considering the revelation, head tilting slowly from side to side on the long column of her slender neck, like a tree swaying in a breeze. He wondered if that reaction was just her expertise in human psychology taking a knock. She didn't know his mind as well as she thought. She still reminded him of a Nara artist, a Kaminoan mime dancer. He'd always been baffled by Nara as a kid, because Kaminoans didn't feel a thing, and yet they loved a kind of ballet that mimed emotions they didn't appear to have. That summed up their lives. And his, he realized.
"Time for analysis later. Get to work."
Still holding his blaster on the scientist, Fett took 3 paces to the computer console and slid the data breaker into the port. The device sparkled with blue and green status lights to show that it was searching and downloading, and he let it gather a lot more data than he needed. He wasn't a thief, but other Arcanian micro data might come in handy. And even save his life, He was just taking custody of a copy of it. "I don't make deals," he said. The status bar indicated that 5,000 exabytes of data had been swallowed whole. Complete genomes took a lot of memory. "But here's a promise. Tell me all you know about COSI, and I won't hand this data over to the highest bidder. That'll make sure you're still of use to Arcanian Micro."
"She's dead."
"I still want to know everything." Town Wee paused for a moment, blinking slowly at the blaster.
"Are you going to take me back to Kamino by force?"
"No, I don't need the credits."
"But would you kill me, Boba?"
He paused. "For this I would." "Yes." She still seemed puzzled, not hurt or afraid or betrayed.
"Very well. COSI thought the cloning program would be destroyed, so she defected to the Separatists during the Battle of Kamino to save her life's work."
"And her own skin."
"We are not materialistic, Boba. It was not about payment. It was about pride, about excellence."
Fett slipped the data breaker back in his belt. "Get on with it. Where did she go?"
"I have no idea where her journey took her next."
"What happened to her?"
"She was traced."
"By who?" Another pause. Whatever it was giving Town Wee problems.
"Clone intelligence unit. And one of your father's commando instructors?"
Fett swallowed hard. He hadn't expected that. "And?" She indicated the braided Wookiee pelts strung from his right shoulder plate.
"She fell prey to the Mandalorian penchant for souvenirs."
"Interesting," said Fett. "No, it's astonishing. It's terrifying. It's hope. It's everything. So the clones got their revenge?"
"We assumed so. Packages arrived. Parts of a Kaminoan body whose genetic profile was COSI's."
Fett found that unnecessarily brutal. Kill a prisoner if you were paid to. Kill them if you needed to. Even retrieve parts if you had to. But mailing COSI home a piece at a time sounded like a vengeful, elaborate message. "And her data?"
"We can only assume they took that, too. It has never been recovered."
"What was special about it?"
"COSI's triumph was controlling the aging process. She knew how to manipulate it better than any other biologist. We were interested only in accelerating it to mature clones faster. But I can see how many would find slowing the process and its therapeutic potential an attractive commodity. She claimed she was able to achieve it in the laboratory."
Myrta had met an original Kamino clone, she claimed. A clone who couldn't, shouldn't, be alive today. Fett found a slew of puzzle pieces dumped in his lap, all fitting together. Impossible clones, dismembered Kaminoan scientist, missing cloning data. "You got any names?"
Town Wee stiffened. "Do you remember that aggressive little human called Skirata? The one who threatened my colleagues with a knife so frequently?"
Yes, he remembered Cal Skirata, all right. Sometimes his father swore he was the best of the bunch. Sometimes he just swore at him and lashed out. Jango Fett rarely lost his temper, but Skirata had a talent for making that happen. He was ferociously and uncompromisingly Mandalorian. As a lonely kid on Kamino, Fett had narrowly escaped being forced to learn Mandoa from Skirata's wildly unpredictable Special Forces trainees, six clone dark troopers who answered only to him. They were intelligence units, the Nulls, as everyone called them, the first batch of clones, and they had turned out crazy, hyper-smart, and dangerous. They had disappeared when the war ended. Yes, this was a neat pattern. Skirata lived for his clones. He'd want them to live out full lives like ordinary men. He would have wanted COSI's data and expertise very badly. butchering her to get the genetic technology he needed to stop the accelerated aging would have been nothing to him, just a means to an end. And if one of Skirata's clone troops was still alive and fully active today, when he should have been the equivalent of a 140-year-old, it meant that they'd found a way to stop the accelerated aging process. Kosai's way.
That's what I need. That will save my life.
Fett was suddenly enveloped in a sensation of vivid awareness, like a pleasantly cool shower on a hot day. The colors around him seemed instantly vibrant, the sounds crystal clear, the smells sharp. Adrenaline coursed through him. He'd found what he was looking for, or the route to it, at least. He'd never failed to track a bounty. Never. Even if a few had escaped in the end, he had always found them.
I'll find you, too.
Useful, said Fett. Holding the blaster level was making his forearm ache. He'd never felt that before.
You keep quiet about this, and I'll keep this data to myself. Got it?
Agreed, said Townwee. And if, when you find Kosai's data, we would give you an excellent fee for its return.
He suddenly thought of Sintas, her eyes brimming with tears of joy as she held baby Aelin. No, Townwee couldn't possibly care about him like a real mother. Townwee's first thought was for her science.
"Maybe I don't want to sell it," said Fett.
"What do you plan to do with your legacy?"
"What?"
"You're dying. And even if you succeed in finding Kosai's data, and it can help you, then you still face the question of what legacy you will leave behind."
"Why does that worry you?"
"I believe it was a concern to your father. He told Count Dooku that he did not want a son. He wanted an apprentice to be Jester's legacy."
That stung. Maybe Townwee didn't mean it the way it sounded. He remained deadpan and wished he had kept his helmet on.
Jester Mareel was more than Dad's mentor. He was a father.
That seemed to mean nothing to Townwee.
And what is that legacy?
To be Mandalore. To make sure Mandalorians survive, whatever happens. And I'll live up to my father's pledge just as he did before me.
Townwee remained glacial.
We will exceed any offer.
Dad was always looking back at Jester Mareel, feeling he had to live up to him. Maybe I was a second chance to do that.
I'll let you know.
Jester's legacy. Bevine's got a point. More Mandalore, less business.
Maybe she said it to wound him. No, Kaminoans didn't care about anything, even if they were almost your mother. He put on his helmet and turned to leave. Would she raise the alarm? She wouldn't want anyone to know that her data had been compromised. All she cared about was her work, as she always had, and that would buy her silence. If Arcanian Micro ran any security checks, they would find nothing missing, and no botched attempts at slicing their system. It was between him and Townwee.
"I would like to know if you find Kosai's research and if it cures you," she said.
Fett resisted the urge to ask if that was personal or professional concern.
"If I'm still around in a couple of years, you will."
He left the way he had come in, crawling back up the hazmat access hatch with the aid of his grappling hook and covering the distance to the edge of the roof in a rapid crawl. The disruptor clips were still in place. Checking around him, he jetted over the fence, released the clips, and as far as the fence sensors were concerned, he had never been there. Slave One's ramp lowered via his remote helmet link, and he stepped up it, wondering why he clung so fiercely to his father's ship. It was a wonderful vessel, but it meant more to him than just the best his fortune could buy.
"I'm in my 70s now, and I've only just started to be more than someone's son. Doesn't mean I love you any less, Dad, but I can't look back forever."
Boba Fett wasn't certain what would fill that void and show him his purpose in life, but he knew now that it lay ahead of him, and not behind him, frozen in memories. He stood in front of Slave One, an icon of his childhood, and wondered where the line between trademark and trap was drawn. "So you didn't trash the cockpit," he said, opening the conversation for once. Myrta was wiping the console. It looked remarkably shiny. Fett kept a clean, well-maintained ship, but this time it looked polished.
"Did you get what you came for?" she asked.
He kicked Slave One into life and lifted her clear, looping under the monorail that snaked 2 kilometers above Vohai's surface. "I did."
"What now?"
Fett took refuge behind his visor. He was torn now. He needed to find that impossibly old clone, and he wanted to see Aelin, and he wanted to know how Sintas had died. Myrta knew, or claimed to know, all 3 answers. Sintas's fate now wasn't urgent, and he could find Aelin for himself— because he could find Han Solo, and where Solo was, Aelin would follow. So he needed to track that clone of Skirata's. Even if he didn't have Kosai's data, he might be good for a tissue sample that a Kaminoan could examine and reverse-engineer. Still too many uncertainties, still too many variables. Fett decided it was time to reveal his interest, but carefully. "Where did you run into that clone?"
"Coruscant. Seemed to be a regular trip for him."
Myrta stared straight ahead as usual.
"So where are we heading?"
"To find Han Solo, because that'll lead me to Aelin." He staged a conversational diversion. "You've got the necklace. You tell me where we're heading." Myrta took the leather cord from her neck and stared at the shimmering stone in her palm.
"Let's try Coruscant."
"Aha." Fett had never taught Aelin anything about bounty hunting, but she had obviously learned that you could often hide better on a planet that was one vast city of 1 trillion people than you ever could in a cave up a mountainside on the outer rim. Fett laid in a course for the galactic core, 000. Slave One was about to make the jump to hyperspace when the comlink console flashed impatiently in front of him. The point of origin said Corellia, even if the sender had tried to disguise the source with multiple relays. Fett didn't get a lot of calls from Corellia, and when he did, they usually weren't the kind that he wanted to take in front of Myrta Gav. "Time to eat," he said. "Get back aft and see what you can find in the stores for us." Myrta obeyed in silence, without a hint of dissent on her face. It was the response of someone used to following orders, not a woman who spent her time in the kitchen.
"Okay."
"Not insulted by that, are you?" Myrta looked at him as if he were mad.
"My father was Mandalorian, so I can fight and cook."
Fett realized how little he knew about the small details of his own culture. Next time he saw Bevine, he'd ask the man to explain all that. He waited for Myrta to close the internal hatch behind her, and then switched the call to a secure circuit. "Fett here. Make it fast." There was a slight pause.
"And this is Traken Sal Solo, Corellian head of state. I've got a proposal for you."
Squadron Training Section Airspace, Centex 2. The XJ-7 below Luke jinked to port and fell away beneath him with astonishing speed. Even for him, Jaina Solo was a serious challenge in aerial combat.
"Or maybe I'm slowing down."
Luke throttled his own XJ-7 into a dive, plummeting into the moon's canyons in pursuit of Jaina. He'd thought she'd had enough flight time recently not to need to sharpen her skills. But when Jaina said she was returning to active service, she meant it. She went on exercises with the squadron, just like the new intake, colonel or not. It was a live-fire exercise, too. Some of the pilots had never been shot at for real, it tended to change their perspective of warfare. Beneath them, on the valley floor, a droid anti-aircraft battery let loose with ion cannons. The red bolts of energy soaring up at him seemed to merge into a single field, with the red halos of the XJ-7's engines, as Jaina zipped between the bolts, rolling instantly through 180 degrees to narrow the fighter's profile, and sending a stream of fire into the ion cannons. She leveled out at the bottom of the canyon behind the battery, and Luke dropped down behind her, shaving the canyon floor so closely that the downdraft from the XJ-7 threw up a cloud of tiny pebbles that hammered under the fuselage. Luke sent a volley of fire after her, aiming a few degrees wide of her starboard wings. The canyon wall spat plumes of pulverized rock in her path, and she skimmed over it. She broke calm silence, which wasn't like her.
"Don't play, Uncle. It won't help me."
He realized he could have taken a serious shot, and he still might not have hit her. But he couldn't fire in earnest on his niece, even if he knew she could almost certainly evade it. It was the almost he didn't like. "I'm breaking," he said, and climbed sharply to level out at a cruising altitude. "See you back at the mess." Syntax 2 was a sterile moon with the usual sprawl of military facilities, arranged like a warehouse floor covered in boxes. The base would win no prizes for architecture. If war broke out for real, and Luke always found the "for real" proviso painfully ironic, then it would switch overnight from a training squadron to an operational air station. The switch seemed close to being thrown. Luke lifted the canopy of the XJ-7 and climbed out of the cockpit to slide down the ladder wheeled into position by ground crew.
"I used to do that a lot faster, too."
He waited at the entrance to the mess until Jaina's fighters swept into the hangar on repulsor power and settled in the bay next to his. When she slid out and took off her helmet, her face was taut and anxious.
"You're up to speed," Luke said comfortingly, walking toward the doors to get her to follow him. "Are we allowed to wear flight suits in the mess?"
Jaina managed to smile and indicated her own orange suit.
"Don't worry. I'm the colonel. I'll provide top cover."
It was the first chance Luke had grabbed since the Corellian internment row to talk to Jaina alone. She radiated misery. Anxiety about skills fade and being fit for role, phrases that had peppered her conversation rather too liberally in recent days to convince Luke, was good tech talk for the sake of the squadron. Nothing more. She was Jason's twin. Whatever was happening, it was happening to her more acutely than the rest of the family.
"After you," said Luke.
The mess was a warren of compartments with one large section where food was served and eaten, and a lounge area almost the same size that was scattered with comfortable seating and sparse entertainment, the main focus of which was a huge holoscreen on one wall. It was wide enough to be seen comfortably from the refectory area, while pilots and ground personnel waited for meals to be dispensed. Most of the pilots in the lounge area had their backs to the refectory and were watching the screen. The lunchtime HNE news had started, and that now meant complete silence descended. Everyone was waiting and watching for the little twitches from the politicians. That would mean that the squadron's warned status would switch immediately to mobilized. Jaina reached over the counter to scoop some vegetables onto her plate, just as the top headline boomed to fill the entire complex. It didn't, of course, but Luke felt that it did. He froze. "And today's top story. The roundup of Corellian nationals continues as thousands leave Galactic City in a voluntary repatriation program." The screen was filled with a shot of 967 Commando shock troopers advancing down the walkways at either side of a Coruscant residential sky lane. One squad preceded by the now familiar figure of Jason Solo, in a stark black coverall of the kind favored by Special Forces. That would have been bad enough, but the only other person in any kind of uniform with his face visible was Ben. It was very, very quiet in the mess now. My son, how did I ever let Jason do this to him? The shock troopers all wore fully enclosed helmets. It was sensible equipment for a soldier to wear, but that didn't make it look any less menacing. Luke could hear not the commentary pounding in his ears, but Han's voice saying that the Alliance was rapidly turning into the Empire. "Colonel Jason Solo, speaking earlier, said—" Luke managed to look at Jaina, whose face was stricken. There was no other word for it. And it was clear that most of those watching the screen had no idea who was standing behind them in the refectory.
"Old family tradition, terrorizing the population," said one captain, feet propped on a low table. "Just like his grandfather all over again. When's he going to go for a nice black cloak and helmet? And lots of troopers in lovely white armor."
Some of the officers in the mess laughed, but most looked as if they wished they were somewhere else. Luke had grown adept at reading the ebb and flow of trouble waiting to explode, and it surprised him again just how finely balanced it was between tempers fading and sudden explosion. This time it was Jaina who exploded. Her fists were balled. Luke, caught off guard by his own shame at Ben's appearance, failed to block Jaina's force push as the captain hit the wall of the mess, upending his chair. Jaina lunged forward. Luke managed to shove in front of her. Two other pilot officers stepped in, sending chairs tumbling to stop their comrade from doing anything else stupid.
"He didn't mean it," said one.
He didn't seem to see Luke.
"Sorry, Colonel."
Jaina was flushed, eyes wide. Colonels didn't take swings at other officers, using the force or not. It was bad discipline. Luke wanted to get her outside, but she needed to let it be known she was back in control. Nobody enjoyed serving under an officer who couldn't control her temper. The captain was hauled to his feet. He looked more winded than injured.
"Go on," said one of the officers. "Apologize to the colonel. You were out of line."
The captain's expression said that he thought he'd got it about right, but his mouth did as it was told.
"My apologies, Colonel Solo."
"We're all getting a little tense," said Jaina. "I should have found a less assertive way to ask you to retract what you said about my family."
And now the captain appeared to realize he was also facing Luke Skywalker.
"Sorry, sir."
It hurt, because everyone's saying it, thought Luke. "You're just the messenger."
"Forget it," he said.
"Jaina, let's take a walk." There was no natural vegetation on Sentax. They found a spot in the shade of a hangar and sat down on a couple of crates.
"We can fence around this, or we can blurt it out," said Luke.
"I prefer blurting, personally.
Saves time."
"I don't know what's happening to Jason."
"Neither do I, Uncle."
"Try a guess, then."
"I don't know him anymore."
"That's a scary thing for any twin to say."
"There's something dark about him now. He shuts me out. He even manipulated me against the Chiss."
"I know. Yes, he's good at that."
"It's worrying."
"I can't trust him now."
Luke didn't want to hear it said aloud, but he knew he had to listen. Mara sensed it, too, but was satisfied that it was the opposing passions of a messy love affair that were creating the darkness. Luke thought of the images he had seen in recent days, and knew that the darkness was separate from any problems Jason had in his love life. It was graphic enough to be captured on holocam.
"I want my son to stay away from him."
Luke thought of Lumia, and his dreams of the hooded figure, which was surely her. But those signs of impending disaster were new. Jason had opened the rift with Jaina by tricking her into attacking the Chiss several years earlier. Jedi were used to seeing what ordinary people couldn't. Being deceived, something regular folk learned to live with from an early age, was especially threatening for them.
"But you're not fooling me, Jason. You're turning to the dark side."
"Uncle Luke, this is none of my business," said Jaina, "but if I were you, I'd get Ben a new teacher."
Luke knew she was right, and he also knew that Mara would fight that every step of the way. And so would Ben. Bravo Company, 967 Commando, Vehicle Checkpoint, Galactic City, Lower Levels, 23:30 hours.
"We left the best till last," said Corporal LeCouf.
Ben was confident in his lightsaber skills, but the lower levels of Galactic City made him envy the soldier's armor. It was the first time he'd been to the city's grim heart, and it wasn't like the Senate sectors at all. In fact, it wasn't even like the slightly seedy Corellian neighborhoods, where there had been a pleasant sense of normal family life going on, at least before the raids had begun. At night, the lower levels were genuinely intimidating. Ben kept one hand on the hilt of his lightsaber. One soldier from Bravo Company set a vehicle barrier across the end of the road. A chain of small spherical droids, whose armament and stinger cords could stop a vessel attempting to pass anywhere up to 30 meters away. There was another one at the far end of the street. The only level below this one was made up of utility tunnels.
"I really hope we don't end up going down there."
Standing well behind the barriers were small knots of people, human and other species, who looked as if they might cut Ben's throat just out of curiosity.
"This is horrible," he said. "Beats doing this in broad daylight with HNE breathing down our necks," said LeCouf.
Maybe he had a point. The media never cared what happened to residents of the lower levels.
"We can just go in and clear this place out. This isn't a Corellian neighborhood. Not all the threats are Corellian."
LeCouf turned at the sound of jogging boots, and Ben followed his gaze to see Captain Chevu approaching. The only way Ben could tell the 967 apart, when they were fully armored, was by the name tags on their chest plates and their variations in build and height. Chevu had a single, discreet gold star on his helmet. LeCouf had two thin gold stripes, and Witter, one of the sergeants, had three. Apart from that, they were an anonymous mass of black plastoid plates over black fatigues. The CSF, some of whose ranks had volunteered for transfer to the 967, had already nicknamed them Stormies. Everyone seemed to see parallels with Ben's grandfather's day. Ben wasn't ashamed of his lineage, and he wasn't ashamed of the work he had to carry out. He just didn't understand how it all got this bad so quickly. But so far, nobody had been shot or badly injured. Every Corellian who had been detained was alive and well, or had been deported. It must have been hard, Ben thought, to be sent home if the only home you had ever known was Coruscant. But in that case, why weren't they loyal to the planet where they'd been born? Just as he'd thought he was growing up, Ben felt like a kid again, a kid who had missed something important that all the adults knew but weren't telling him.
"Okay, listen up," said Chevu.
He gathered two squads around him, pulling in Ben and LeCouf, too.
"Best intelligence is that Customs and Immigration got a tip-off about three Corellian agents and a bounty hunter they made contact with, and CSF tracked them down here."
The location was an apartment block with some boarded-up windows that sat between a sleazy bar and a brightly lit building whose business Ben wasn't sure about, except that the staff all seemed to be women.
"That's who we've come for. Names are Khotan, Abadaner, Balf, and Tabur."
Chevu handed Ben a data pad with pictures on it. The squads were receiving the images via the HUDs in their helmets.
"They know we're here," Ben said. "Not much they can do about it, then, except come out when we ask nicely," said LeCouf.
Chevu tapped the charge indicator on his blaster rifle.
"Double-check them against your feature recog software, because they're going to be seriously armed, and you might need to put them out of business permanently.
Colonel Solo's covering the rear exits with two squads if things don't go to plan.
It wasn't a raid so much as a siege. Ben had learned an awful lot about storming buildings in a very short time. He didn't feel that he was much use, but LeCouf reassured him that he could do things no ordinary soldier could when they needed him to.
"Okay, let's start this like good guys," Chavu said.
He turned toward the front of the apartment block, and there was an audible click from his voice projection unit. He was about to use the loudhailer setting. Ben braced for painfully loud noise.
"This is the security forces."
Chavu's voice vibrated off the buildings, slow and carefully enunciated. People still in the street behind the barricade scattered and ran for cover.
"Coton, Abedanner, Balfe, Habur, surrender your weapons. Come out of the building and keep your arms above your heads. You can come out now, or we will enter and detain you."
Maybe I could try mind influence, thought Ben. A bolt of blaster fire spat from a window, and the squad returned fire as if by reflex. Okay, maybe that isn't going to work.
"We tried," said Chavu. "Blasters only, no projectiles. Don't want anything penetrating walls, because we've got civilians in there." He opened the loudhailer again. "Residents, stay in your homes with your doors closed. Armed security forces are entering your building. I repeat, stay in your homes."
He shook his head, muttering about CSF failing to evacuate the apartment block in advance, and signaled the squads to enter. Ben could see at least two squads on the roof clambering into a maintenance access hatch. There were no stairways in some of these blocks, which meant each turbolift lobby was a potential killing field. It took guts to step out of a lift into the unknown. But that, LeCouf told Ben, was what armor was for.
"Wear it," Chavu ordered. "Put a flashbang through that window on my mark, will you?"
"Sir," said the sergeant, and slipped a charge into the feed of his grenade launcher.
"Squads, when you access the fourth floor, we'll light them up from here. Count us down."
Ben couldn't hear the response. He really wanted a helmet with full comlink. But what he lacked in technology, he almost made up for with his own force senses. Now that he focused on the shattered and gaping window where the blaster fire had emerged, he could feel the fear and hostility inside. There was a lot of general fear in the building, almost certainly the cumulative terror of other residents who were stuck inside the block.
"Once we've neutralized the main targets, we'll do a sweep of all the apartments just to be certain," said Chavu. "Can't guarantee that CSF identified everyone. Ben, are you up for playing sniffer droid for us?"
"Yes, sir."
It wasn't a game anymore, but he desperately wanted to play his part.
"Who do we lift then, sir?"
LeCouf asked.
"Anyone with a criminal record? That's pretty well the whole neighborhood."
"No, only the ones we think we might be interested in," said Chavu, "or we'll be here all night."
The raid was surprisingly quiet. Ben could see the occasional flare of light through windows as blasters discharged, and heard the accompanying faint badat, badat, badat of rounds. It was as if the whole neighborhood was holding its breath, waiting for the fighting to be over. Without the comlinks to the rest of Bravo Company, he couldn't tell how far they had penetrated the building, and Jason was not only silent, but shut down in the force. Ben couldn't feel him at all. He wondered if his master—and Jason was his master, whatever the Jedi Council said—now hid his presence instinctively as a defense mechanism. Then Wirrut reacted as if someone unseen had tapped him on the shoulder. He aimed his grenade launcher, and there was a whoosh of gas as the flashbang shot into the building. Ben caught the fallout of the deafening sound and blinding light even from 20 meters away, and his ears took a few seconds to hear the shouts and the hammering sound of blaster bolts as soldiers stormed the apartment. Silence fell. Chavu cocked his head as if listening, and the faint wail of a child somewhere inside made Ben's hair stand on end.
"Okay," said Chavu. "Two targets down, two unaccounted for. Ben, with me. Let's work our way down from the top. Every apartment that opened its doors voluntarily to them was full of suspicious, hostile faces that were clearly no strangers to visits from the authorities. But Ben sensed no purpose or immediate danger. He kept close to Shavu, and when they emerged on the next floor, Jason was already crouched outside one apartment, talking earnestly to a couple of 967 men. He beckoned Ben to him.
"What do you sense in there, Ben?"
Ben closed his eyes and imagined the rooms beyond the double doors. He'd seen the interiors of enough apartments in the block now to picture the layout within. When he concentrated, he felt the prickling in his throat that indicated an immediate threat, and his mind was drawn to one room where a man and a woman, he knew that and wasn't quite certain how, had some grim purpose.
"I don't like the feel of that either," said Jason.
He seemed particularly troubled by it. Ben thought he would have been used to violent intentions by now.
"I think that's our two missing targets."
"The old-fashioned way, sir."
One of the 967 held up a row of detonator ribbon.
"Let's try a little REBJ," said Jason, drawing his lightsaber.
The squad with him stacked on either side of the door.
"That's what you call it, isn't it? Rapid entry by Jedi?
Okay, here goes. Rapid!"
Jason held up his left hand and lowered it along the line where the two doors joined, not touching them. He was a clear meter away. The doors shot apart, slamming back into the housing on either side, and Jason's lightsaber seemed to have a life of its own as he deflected red blaster bolts that flared from inside the apartment. Ben should have known better than to stand behind him, and Shavu went to pull him aside, but he fended off a stray blaster bolt and piled in behind Jason on blind instinct. Two people inside, yes, a man and a woman, he'd been right, aimed at Jason, but the blasters flew from their hands as if snatched by an unseen hand. The woman, about as old as Ben's mother, dark hair scraped back from her face and a tattoo across one eye, scrambled to reach for something, probably another blaster. But Jason slammed her flat against the wall with the force and pinned her there. The man lay slumped against a chair, groaning. The squad poured in, and the two prisoners were cuffed and dragged out. Shavu eased off his helmet and stood wiping his forehead on the back of his glove.
"You're going to have to give us a list of your functions, sir," he said with a faint smile. "Can't quite keep up with your box of tricks."
"Neither can I sometimes," said Jason.
He turned to Ben.
"You okay?"
"Fine," said Ben. It was over for the time being. They could go back to barracks. He could feel the shaking in his legs that always followed an adrenaline rush, and the relief made him feel almost tearful. He bit his lip discreetly.
"You were going to tell me something a few days ago."
Jason always seemed to know how Ben was feeling. He knew exactly when to ask a question and when Ben would find it hard not to answer.
"Remember?" "About what?"
"Something about reporting someone."
"Ah, Barrett." Ben suffered indecision again. Barrett hadn't actually shot anyone, but he'd tried pretty hard. Was it right to turn him in? He might have already been interned or deported, but he might not. And whatever sympathy Ben might have felt for him, he might try again.
"You're in this now. You know what the stakes are. You're not here to be liked. And Jason needs you. He needs you to be loyal."
"The family is called Psi," said Ben. "They run an engineering company."